Victory or death!
Victory or death!
Victory or death!
Victory or death!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon. This is episode 21-13, the 13th episode of 2021. And in today's show, I'm actually going to be doing an interview with a candidate for Attorney General in Virginia named Jason Miaris. I'm also going to be talking about a blog post that been making the rounds called The Mathematics of Confiscation, and give you a little window into why that would be a very, very hard thing to do. And then I will, of course, share another chapter of I Led Three Lives. Making some progress on the t-shirt and merch front. Got a couple more ideas for slogans and things on shirts. There are some things I'd like to say that I'm pretty sure the folks at these companies would consider something that's not allowed. So I'm thinking what I'll do to get around that is actually write it in Russian Cyrillic. One shirt that I think will be okay, that I think might get away with, is going to be snitches get stitches and communists get ditches. So we'll see how that goes. But there's still a lot of work that's got to be done and not enough hours in the day to do it. So I will update you once that's up. But I expect within the next 30 days, I'll have all that online and you'll be able to get some Radio Free Virginia merch and support the show and represent the fight against communism. And that's what we are. We're in a fight. We're in a fight against communism. It is exactly what's going on right now. And it's quite surprising that they're being as blatant as they are. Kind of makes me wonder what's coming. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Acticare of the Blue Ridge, ACTICARE.com/blue-ridge. Acticare is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. Whether you're in Smith Mountain Lake, Bedford, Campbell, Roanoke, out in the country, Lynchburg, get in touch with them. Find out what they can do for you and how they will genuinely take good care of your loved one. ACTICARE.com/blue-ridge. I was actually hanging out with the owner this weekend. We were putting up a gate on a property that he's got. Never done that before, so was happy to offer to help, and it was an interesting process, never done that before, so now I know how to do it. But got a chance to get out in the sunshine, short-lived as it was on Saturday, and now we've had almost two straight days of rain and wind, no flying the remote control plane, sadly. Well, I'm going to jump right into this interview here with Jason Miaris. It's spelled M-I-Y-A-R-E-S, Miaris, Miaris. And he's running for attorney general. There is a drive-through convention, kind of a distributed thing happening all across the Commonwealth. I will post the link to his website in the show notes. Of course, all the articles and the things I talk about will be in the show notes. And the show outline is in the show notes. You can find that at radiofreeva.com. Radiofreeva.com will get you the show notes, and you can click the links and find what you're looking for. But Jason said some interesting things in our interview, and he talked about what the justice system is becoming, and it's really shifting from a victim first, criminal last to criminal first, victim last system here in Virginia. And you can see that with some of the laws I've talked about. I've talked about some of these different laws that pertain to criminal justice and what they're doing. Things like making it only a misdemeanor to destroy a statue and different things like that. They're doing everything they can to bend over backwards for these criminals. And it was a really good interview. I enjoyed talking with him and learning about who he is and how he grew up. And I did the interview a little differently than more of a focus on trying to get you an insight into who he was and who he is and how he grew up. He's native of Virginia. And I think you will enjoy this. Now, I will warn you, there are some audio issues. First time doing a remote interview was using Zoom, and there was a few glitches here and there. Kind of like the old days when a cell phone would drop out for a second, kind of like that. But I think it's worth muscling through if you're one of the people like me, and mainly this is because of the show that I do, that has troubles with audio issues on stuff. So let's cut to the interview. I'd like to welcome Jason Miaris, candidate for Attorney General, the Attorney General's race, vying for the Republican Party of Virginia's slot. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I know you're on a tight schedule, so I'm going to jump right in. Basically, what I want to do is kind of build the history of who you are. You know, you're growing up in Virginia. Talk a little bit about, you know, your work, and then your work in the House of Delegates, and then we'll talk about this election, and then we'll wrap it up. And so we'll just kind of go from right there. And so I'd like to talk first about the history. You know, you're a native Virginian, born in 1976, raised in Virginia Beach. And I was curious if, you know, you could just talk about, because Virginia Beach has changed a lot over the years. I mean, I go and visit every once in a while. I've got family up in Newport News, and but it's changed a lot. What was it like growing up there? And what was high school like there?
This is an awesome community. It's a very military, patriotic community. Outside of Christmas, July 4th is always the biggest holiday of the year. We have the highest concentration of military personnel, active duty and retire, of any community in the country. So this is an area that both is deeply patriotic, a lot of veterans, but you also see the scars of war. I mean, it is not uncommon to be on the beach, the ocean front, and, you know, see your compatriots, see your fellow Americans, see your fellow Virginian, literally, with the scars of our most recent conflicts of the war on terror. So it gives you deep appreciation for our country and the men and women that wear the uniform and make the sacrifices they do. And growing up, what's kind of unusual, you know, not unusual, but you realize what's unusual for Virginia Beach compared to others is you have so many friends that are in the military that get deployed that it's not unusual for, oh, my dad's just gone for the next 6 months. And, you know, my neighbor growing up, his father was in the Navy, and so many of my friends, so most, if not all of my closest friends in high school were the children of those that served in the Navy and the other armed forces. And the other thing you get used to is your friends move away. And that kind of stinks, but that's part of the culture of Virginia Beach, is you also have friends that move away. I had a friend that moved away in junior high and then get back to school in my sophomore year, and he's back again because they got restationed here. So it's a great community, great people, very patriotic, and I'm really, really blessed to be able to call it home.
Awesome. Next question is, this was really interesting because what you may not know is I talk a lot about communism and fighting communism here on this show. Mm. And your mom fled from communist Cuba. I was watching this video and I'm like, oh, this is amazing, you know, and I'm curious, how has that shaped your view of communism, or what the left would call socialism, here in America? And what kind of stories did your mother tell you, or what does she tell you, you know, seeing something on the news and going, oh my gosh?
Oh, well, I will tell you, it affects every part of you. So my mother, you know, I often say my story doesn't begin in Virginia Beach. It begins in Havana, Cuba, when a scared 19-year-old girl who's terrified got on an airplane, penniless and homeless, and not knowing where her next meal was going to come from. And that was my mother, Miriam Miaris. And when you grow up in the household of somebody who experienced 5+ years of the hell of Castro's communist socialist paradise, it's not a theory. It's not just something you read in a textbook. It is literally that the impact of it is literally in your DNA. And it's something that is constantly brought up over the dinner table on family vacations, obviously, anytime that we visit Miami. But, you know, the ultimate reason why I decided to run, conversation that I had the Friday night before the election, where my mother said, listen, I never thought the rhetoric that I used to hear in Havana, Cuba in the 1960s, I would be hearing in America today. And all the times and all the conversations I've had with my mom about politics, it was the first time I ever heard her scared, literally scared. And that really impacts you. I mean, I come from a broken home. It's a hard thing as a son to hear your mom scared. And so that was a big reason why I decided to jump in. And she said, you know, the communists and the socialists, they will always misguide what their intentions are. When Castro was coming down from the mountains, a lot of people suspected he was a leftist, and he would say, you know, don't worry, my revolution is as green as the palm tree, i.e. it's capitalist. But as soon as he got power, the Cubans all joked that it was really like a watermelon. It was green on the surface, but as soon as he got power, it was red. And they would first, they nationalized big banks, and then the small banks, and the big farms, and the small farms, and the big businesses, and the small businesses, until finally they came to my mother's home. That's the last thing that happened before she left Cuba, is they literally came to our home, and they posted a notice on her door, property of the revolution. And imagine if everything, imagine for your listeners listening right now, imagine somebody coming from the government and putting a notice on the door, and every single thing you have in this world, every picture frame, every piece of jewelry, anything that's personal to you is now taken from you. And it's all done in the name of fairness and equity and redistribution of wealth. And, you know, it reminds you of that great line from C.S. Lewis, who said, you know, of all the tyrannies in the world, the worst tyrannies are always the tyrannies done for your own good. And that's probably what's so hideous about, you know, the socialism, communism matrix, is they are using words that sound sweet to the ear, things like equality and redistribution of wealth and fairness. But the reality is they are denying people their individual freedoms and their individual desires and taking it all away from them, all in the name of fairness. And so, you know, one of the most vivid stories I had is my mother had deep desire to be a doctor in Cuba. And her first day at the University of Havana, she went to go register for classes, and the communists had taken over. And they had told her, no, we don't need you to be. We don't need you to be a doctor. The party needs you to be a teacher. So you're not allowed to take pre-med classes. And it's what I love to tell high school kids. That is an example of all in the name of the collective good. She was not able to chase after and pursue her own individual desires. That's the opposite of what we have. That is the brilliance of this country. So, you know, my mom left in the fall of 1965, literally with nothing, leaving a country where there was no consent of the governed. And almost 50 years later, to the day that she left, in the fall of 2015, she was able to vote for her son to represent her in the oldest democracy in the Western Hemisphere, the Virginia House of Delegates. And that's what I call the American miracle. I don't know of any other countries you can find a story like that. But that's what makes this country, this genius of this country, this genius of freedom, genius of free markets, is nobody's telling you you can't pursue your own individual dreams and you can't use your God-given talents to the best of their ability. There's no powers of being from doing that. And that is what made this country so proper. She's like, you know, I'm 74 years old. I'm too old to ever go through this again. And that's the driving reason why I'm running to be the next attorney general, is because I'm passionate about protecting people's individual freedoms and protecting what this American miracle is, because I think it is being attacked and it's under assault like it's never been before.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going through a book called I Led Three Lives on the show, and it's about a man who infiltrated the Communist Party as an FBI informant. And the stuff in the book is stuff they're doing now. And they were doing it in secret then, and now they're just right out in the open doing it. It's pretty amazing. And so that's an amazing story. And I'll marvel at people who made it out. That's just, incredible. And then for school, you went to James Madison, you went to College of William and Mary. You know, curiosity for me is, what made you choose those schools? No statement there. I'm just curious. What was formative when you were there for what you're doing now?
Well, I mean, listen, I think, like a lot of people, I worked my way, through college. I had a situation where, quite frankly, my father abandoned the family. And, I do like to say I have a earthly father that left home, but I have a heavenly father that's never forsaken me. But, you know, when you go through that, you kind of reach the conclusion that you have to, you're going to have to make sure you go to a place that you can afford. And quite frankly, JMU was someplace I could afford. They gave me some money. and I'm very grateful. I'm grateful for my time there. It's where I really first got my start. As a freshman in college in grassroots politics. But yeah, so JMU, I was a business major, was a business school, worked at PC Dukes. I remember they paid me, I think, 30 cents higher than minimum wage, if I recall the minimum wage, I think it was $4.25 an hour. And I thought I was doing great. So I worked PC Dukes. Sunday night was the closing shift that I had to do. So I cleaned grease pots, and can't say I smelled too well at the end of the day, but and graduated JMU, got with a business degree, very proud of that. And then eventually decided the world was in desperate need for another lawyer. So for William & Mary, it was an in-state school. I could be an in-state tuition for law school. Law school is not cheap. And that was, I would say that at William & Mary, I was definitely drawn to the history, knowing how many great Virginia Patriots had gone through there, individuals like John Marshall and Thomas Jefferson had studied law under George Wythe. He was the founder of the law school and also a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And so the history is what really attracted me to William & Mary. I was looking at different law schools that really just drew me to it. Really enjoyed my time in Williamsburg. It's just a really awesome city. If you love history like I do, and you love where we came as a country and our history and our founding fathers like I do, it's a fantastic city to live in. And I also, it was close enough to Richmond that I could see her as I was trying to convince her to say yes to marry me. So,
that's awesome. So did you, when you were in college, did you think, and this, I didn't know this about you, you know, that what you just said, you didn't have this handed to you, you worked for this. And so a lot of guys that are in politics, that's not the story, but that sounds like that's the story for you, that, you know, you.
Yeah. So, yeah. I didn't go to some rich, fancy prep school. You know, I my car that I drove in high school was a 73 Le Mans. It was the same car that I got taken home from the hospital in, and our joke, and I shared it with my two brothers, and our joke was, if you wanted music, sing; if you wanted heat, rub your hands together; if you wanted air conditioning, roll down windows. But it had a big engine and it went fast, but our nickname for it was Tank. And my first job was in summer. I remember one summer I did two jobs, did shifts at McDonald's and then shifts at the Disney store, and doing retail, and worked my way through. But listen, teach you incredible lessons. And one of the most important qualities that we have to install in people, I don't care what the job is, I don't care if where the job is, any job that requires you to show up on time, learn to take orders, learn to present yourself well, learn the idea of accountability and teamwork is you can have a life. So can work, and somehow we've gotten to the notion that some work isn't good enough for people. I utterly reject that. I think that, and not only that, the mental and psychological effects, if you look at the impact of poverty, one of the reasons why the welfare reform that happened in the 1990s was so effective, and why it led to the single biggest drop in childhood poverty in the United States history, was the example that was set from the parents to the child. The child sees that mom or dad, they are not staying home. They're getting up and they're going to work. It is an expectation that when you reach adulthood, you are going to go get a job. And I think that's so important. We've lost a little bit of that. And the reality is if you are remember, if you'd studied the arguments against the Republican welfare reform initiatives back in the 1990s, it was going to be the sky is falling. It's going to be mass starvation in the streets. The reality is it led to a drop in poverty rate and led to huge benefits that in turn presented an example for its children. Gone away from some of that mentality. And that's painful to see. A lot of these great reforms that were done, conservative reforms done in the 1990s, not just in welfare reform, but also on criminal justice, is being reversed. And I think it's going to have predictably a disastrous effect on America.
Okay. So let's talk about criminal justice. So you were a prosecutor in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office in Virginia Beach. And as a prosecutor and lawyer, yeah, you have some insights that my audience might be interested in. And so here's the question I have: how is our system working and how is it broken?
Well, up until this year, up until the Democrats took back power in Richmond, we had the lowest recidivism rate in the country, which means recidivism is how often do people, when they get out of prison, do they go and commit more crimes when they actually get out? Virginia had the lowest recidivism rate and the third or fourth lowest crime rate in the country. And I think the only states that were ahead of us were rural flyover states, which is remarkable given the fact that Virginia has a very large suburban and rural urban areas. And so we had one of the lowest crime rates in the country and the single lowest recidivism rate in the country. And I could tell you as a prosecutor, the well north of 80% of violent crimes done by repeat offenders. And so what Virginia did with Truth in Sentencing that was instituted by George Allen is that if you did the crime, you did the time. Right now, our system is broken. They have literally created a criminal first, victim last mindset in Richmond that is going to have devastating impact, already is, on a host of issues. And what pains me right now is there's nothing they're being proposed that hasn't been tried before in our criminal justice system with disastrous results. It all happened in the 1970s, getting rid of, making it easier for violent offenders to make bond, early release of violent offenders, the ease of bringing back parole, et cetera, et cetera. And when you put violent offenders back in the street, the chances they're going to be committing more violent crime when you're shortening their criminal sentences is sky high. To your audience, is that sentence of 20 years when you're getting out, and know that when these people get out, their chances and the likelihood of committing another crime because they haven't served the full length of their sentence, it is extraordinarily high. So East Bro parole board that has let out at least a half a dozen murders back on our streets just in the last year. If your listeners aren't familiar with the case of Vincent Martin, Vincent Martin was sentenced to 30 years in prison for multiple robberies. He got out after serving only 6 years. He's not even out a year. He commits another armed robbery. While he's leaving the scene of that armed robbery, he's stopped by a young 23-year-old Richmond police officer by the name of Michael Connors. Michael Connors is approaching the car, he's shot in the neck. He's struggling on the ground to survive. And Vincent Martin gets out of the car and calmly puts three bullets in his head. And when he was given life without the possibility of parole, that to me means you don't get out. Well, in today's new progressive Virginia, Vincent Martin's back on the street. He was asked by the media if he had any regrets. He said no. And I think that's the opposite of what we should desire in the criminal justice system. What's worse is they're required by law to let the victims and the families of the victims know before these violent offenders get back on the street. And they didn't. They broke the law. They never even tried to notify them. We have emails now that have been released from whistleblowers that show they didn't even try to contact the families of the victims. So it's just... It's such a callous attitude towards the victims, such a celebratory attitude, letting some of these violent offenders back out on their streets. It's really, really painful to see and to watch and to listen. And, some of the victims' families have been in touch with my office, and I know how painful it is for them. And I look forward to having a robust debate this fall with whoever the Democrats put up.
Well, I heard a great, I don't listen to NPR much, but occasionally I'm hitting scan and I'll come across something. And it said that the justice system is meant to be a barrier between perpetrator and the victim. And it seems like with what you said there, that criminal first, victim last, it reminds me of what I hear about what New York was like back in the day, you know, back before they kind of cleaned it up, and it's kind of going back that way now. But I mean, used to be pretty bad. It was what they made movies about. We're all set in New York, where all the
taxi cab and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, what it reminds me of is it's kind of, and I'm originally from California, so I'm very familiar with, criminal first as a means of,
right,
of how you do justice. And so, that's really interesting insight. Okay. So you've been in the House of Delegates since 2015. So that means you've seen both Republican control and Democrat control of politics in Virginia. What's the big difference in policy? And moreover, how's it run differently? Because to me, when I see, and I talk about this to the listeners, I see Republicans, when they're in control, they just kind of have this slowly move the ball down the field. And when I see the Democrats, they just grab both, offense and defense, and they grab everybody and just go running down the field and, you know, yeah. punching people in the face. And here's what we're going to just get out of our way.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a totally different, well, it's just a different worldview that with, first of all, to show you how much the Democratic Party today has changed, and perhaps maybe your mom and dad or grandparents, Democrat Party in Virginia, the last time the Democrats controlled all branches of government in Richmond, I mean, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, state senator, and House of Delegates, the Democratic majority leader in the House of Delegates was a proud member of the NRA, Dickie Cranwell. And today's Democratic Party is definitely what I would say this progressive woke mindset, where I must hear the words fairness and equity said about five dozen times a day, either in committee or on the House floor. But it really is this mindset, which is we want to use government to try to change every aspect of society possible. Whereas, you know, kind of as somebody like myself, who is a conservative worldview, which is, listen, we want to, as much as possible, to allow people to pursue their individual lives, their individual freedoms. And we don't want government to be controlling every single aspect of anyone's life. That's the opposite of our philosophy. And so it really goes in your mindset. If you believe that government should be involved in every aspect of everyone's life and is the ultimate solution to every single problem faced in society, then you're going to view a very activist government. That's very opposite from those of us who believe in more of a limited government, personal freedom, individual responsibility worldview. And so, yes, it's very, very different. But listen, there's also a certain level of arrogance. I like to say that, you know, the problem with Democrats often is that when they lose, they act like they're never going to win again. And when they win, they act like they're never going to lose again. Because there's a certain level of hubris and arrogance that comes with the way they govern. I'll give you an example. I had a COVID-19 liability bill because I didn't think small businesses or our school boards that wanted to actually be open, I didn't want them to be looking over their shoulders for trial lawyers to sue them in oblivion. And I wanted to provide a certain level of COVID-19 liability protection. Well, the Democrats didn't even bring it up for a hearing. I mean, I had another bill that would enhance the requirement to notify the victims of the parole board before they would let people out, given what we just described earlier with the victims not being notified. They didn't even bring it up for a hearing, but they did bring up for a hearing a bill that banned styrofoam cups, and they did bring up for a hearing a bill that would ban children from releasing balloons. So, I mean, that just goes to show you a little bit of what their priorities are. They can't legislation to find ways to help us reopen our schools, but they can find legislation cups. That's that goes a little bit, shows you what the mentality is, the mindset is in Richmond.
Yeah, yeah. What you said pretty much is my assessment of things and what I've seen. And I review a lot of the bills on the show, talk about them, and I've talked about the marijuana one, which is a whole show in of itself and other things. But let's talk about the election. So what does the Attorney General do in Virginia, and what do you hope to accomplish if you can win?
Well, listen, they call it Virginia's top cop for a reason. And that has been a huge component of what the Attorney General's office does. It handles every single criminal appeal in Virginia. It does a lot of joint prosecutions, both with the feds. Fighting human trafficking is a passion of mine. I've done a lot of work with the Safe House Project. So there's, on the criminal side, there's a lot that you could do on that side. It is also the office that has the standing because of the position you're in. You're literally Virginia's lawyer, that you have the position to challenge any rule and regulation coming out of Washington. You're able to challenge if your governor is issuing executive orders, some of which the governor has done, which I think has violated a variety of constitutional freedoms and liberty. I mean, the fact that we could say our liquor stores are essential business and they need to remain open, but our churches need to remain closed, I think is a direct violation, not just the U.S. Bill of Rights, the Virginia Bill of Rights, the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, and a host of others. But that is what it is the Attorney General has to be, I think, in some way, a watchdog for the people of Virginia. And I think a lot of citizens right now, if you're a small business owner, if you're a pastor, if you want to be able to, quite frankly, just bury your loved one and have a funeral, you don't feel like anybody has your back. You feel media doesn't have your back. And if there's anything I want people to feel, is that they haven't always defend their constitutional freedoms, because I think ultimately that bulwark defense of these liberties is what made us the freest, most prosperous country for more freedom and more liberty and more prosperity for more people from different backgrounds, different faiths, different races than any country in the history of the world. And it is because of our constitutional liberties. I love to ask young people all the time when I'm speaking to civic leagues or high school civic classes or government classes, why did my mom come here? Why was she so desperate to come here? She fled to Spain and then legally immigrated to the United States. And it was because she desperately wanted to live in a country. And that defense, the idea that you can have an attorney general that will defend people, I think is just such a critical part of the mindset of what the attorney general's office should be, is to have the back of the little guy that feels like the media and the government and so many people are really trying to take away their liberties.
Okay, so let's kind of wrap this up here. I've seen that you have a huge list of big endorsements, which is pretty impressive. But they're not all from what you would call establishment candidates. So I saw that Nick Freitas and Matt Ferris are two guys that I've worked with on issues, and they're the furthest from establishment you're ever going to get, and awesome patriots. And I'm sure there's a bunch of others that I'm just not aware of on there. You've got a good website. I'll link that on the show notes page. Any final thoughts or comments you want my audience to know that maybe I didn't cover?
Well, I just want them to know that I am a Reagan conservative, a constitutional conservative. I feel that the liberties of what this country is, what makes us so unique on this planet, is at stake. And if they want somebody who's passionate, somebody quite frankly has a track record of winning. I'm in a district that Ralph Northam's actually won. I've won with an average of 60% of the vote. No one's going to work harder for him. No one's going to be more interested in defending their liberty and defending what it is that makes this country so unique. A free country is not guaranteed to remain free if the very underpinnings of what made this country the freest, most prosperous on earth is literally being torn asunder. And I feel like that's what we're seeing every day. And when we turn on this TV, when we're seeing the cancel culture. So I'll be there, attorney general for the little guy. I want to be there. I want to be there to fight for them. If they want to be part of it, I'm calling our delegates to the Unassemble Convention freedom builders. If they want to be a freedom builder, go to my website. It's jason4ag.com. They could sign up there, but listen, my personal cell phone number, if anybody wants to call me, anybody wants to text me, I used to give this out when I was going door to door and I was first time a House delegate candidate. It won't change when I got elected to the House of Delegates. It won't change if I get elected to the Attorney General's office, because I want to be accountable. I'm a big believer in the Book of Proverbs when it says an abundance of counselors, there's wisdom. So everybody listening can be that abundance of counselors for me. My cell phone is 757-679-5143. Don't hesitate to reach out. Don't hesitate to text me. I look forward to seeing everybody on the trail ahead.
Okay. Well, Jason Miaris, thank you so much for your time and good luck.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
Chapter 16, Professional Revolutionary. When I trudged upstairs late that night, I had reached the lowest ebb of my life. My faith in my fellow man, one of the rocks on which my life was founded, was seriously undermined. Of all the ills of communism, none seemed more evil than this debasement of moral standards, this subversion of the traditional American sense of fair play. I knew that I had collided with one of the complex questions of our day, and it would take time to find the answer, if there was any. One thing I did know, there was only one way to find and expose the underground communist. You had to get right in there with him, down in the muck and mud. There is no other way. Early the next morning, I called Don Richards. "How did it go?" he asked. "Perfect," I replied. "It was very interesting. We had a successful little session. It's hot, really hot." Don made no direct comment when we met to talk it over, but he was plainly encouraged. "You're making progress," was as far as he would go. "Something may come of it yet." Don's natural reticence made his expressions of enthusiasm sound very mild. The pro-group meetings went on and on. For the next year and a half, my Communist Party activities were centered almost entirely around the clever conspiracy of Pro 4. Shock was added to shock as I uncovered gradually the composition of the group. The surprising personalities who went twice a month to homes and apartments in Boston and Cambridge for cell meetings. I learned how the pro-group was organized, approximately how many members there were in its closely knit units, how it functioned with respect to the rest of the party, and where and to what extent it wielded its powerful influence in behalf of Karl Marx, Lenin, and especially Joseph Stalin. At first, the young people I met appeared to be rather agreeable members of the white-collar class, a notch above the secretarial or clerkship level. I hoped that their involvement might have been the result of misguidance. Harry was one exception to this, and my prominent business friend was another. Norma, our hostess at the initial meeting, although on another higher level than an office girl, was less skilled than the others. She was the homey type, and obviously frightened by some of the things she heard in cell meetings. She seemed to be a young woman who was infatuated with the scientific aspects of socialism, and she thought it was smart to know about them. In truth, she would have been better off reading love stories instead for her relaxation, with a box of chocolates on the arm of her chair. Norma's husband, whose party name was Mike, was a certified public accountant, and I understood that he was a member of another pro-cell. Then there was a girl whom I shall call Susan, a bohemian type who thought she wanted to be a writer. Although she was a diligent worker in various front organizations and even on the payroll of two or three, she seemed the least devoted to the dictates of Joseph Stalin of anyone in the group. It became obvious to me that she was unhappy in the party and was staying in because she was afraid of blackmail and knew no easy way out. Indeed, there is no easy out. Watching the pathetic figure of Susan trapped in the party reminded me of the dissertation of the heavy-handed Manny Blum on the matter of potential party traitors and the conditions that may cause them to reconsider. One of those conditions, blackmail. Susan had courage, however, and showed a spark of independent spirit at the time of the Tito-Stalin split during the summer of 1948. She seemed to derive sly enjoyment, reminding her fellow comrades of their previous worshipful attitude toward the great Yugoslav patriot. But she was a sad and sensitive person, and sometimes I had the distinct impression that she was clinging desperately to her sanity. Another member of Pro 4, Butch, was a young artist, also with rather bohemian ways, who lived on Beacon Hill. He was not very bright politically, but was attentive, quick, and talented in other ways. Despite his political naivete, the party put his artistic talents to good use. Peg Gilbert, Miss Margaret Gilbert, served us as a wonderful shield for our pro-group activities. She was held in such high esteem by her neighbors that we could meet at her house with relatively little fear of arousing suspicion. She was a plain young woman with straw-colored hair, the mother of two children, and the wife of a labor union organizer. She herself was a professional, paid worker in a number of front organizations, and a charming hostess at numerous communist social affairs. Why exactly Peggy Gilbert was associated with this group is a mystery to me. Certainly no one in her neighborhood would ever believe that nice Mrs. Gilbert down the street with those lovely children might be party to a conspiracy. A stylish, attractive young woman in the group, Helen, by name, was our courier. She was extremely quiet and wore her expensive clothes like a professional model. Never did she indicate by so much as a word exactly what her job with the group was, but her frequent trips to New York, London, and Paris, with no visible means of support, led the rest of us to the correct conclusion that she was not only a courier, but an international courier. Subsequently, I was to learn about the contacts between the Russian and American Communist parties, although always in general outline and seldom in detail. Although there are four major Soviet espionage networks in America, each operating independently of the others, the 2,000 pro-group members in America serve as the major source of information for one of these espionage systems, and the glamorous, silent Helen was their contact in my own Pro 4. All of this I learned by painfully slow degrees, over the weeks and months of our meetings. It was entirely possible to sit next to a person a dozen times at meeting after meeting, and learn only his party name, nothing more. Our meetings were held at the homes of these and other members of the pro-group. Initially, I wondered if it might be possible that some of them were not really communists after all, but merely dupes who had been lassoed into what they regarded as intellectual discussions about Karl Marx and the history of revolutionary movements. But as the meetings continued and they remained in attendance, this hope was lost. We paid dues at our meetings to the Communist Party. We contributed a special pro-group sustaining fee to the party treasury. We talked about Communist Party affairs, directives, and personalities, and openly discussed the party line. Our meetings followed the normal routine of all party cells. First, a discussion of cell business and activities, followed by a dues collection and sale of literature, and topped off with an educational discussion based on the Marxist classics. And our Marxist education followed the hard, ruthless, Stalinist line. This was the pattern, and it was magnificently impossible, as time went on, that anyone could be there without the full realization that he was deep in the communist movement. All of the members, like me, had been ordered to destroy their cards, and all functioned in secrecy, unknown as communists to their friends, and unknown even to the rank-and-file members of the party, who were entirely unaware that the pro-group existed. Between the fall of 1947 and the spring of 1948, as the cell to which I belonged grew and its membership was gradually rotated, other faces came into the picture. Harry Winner, the quick-witted and affable Malden Rubber Company executive and Samuel Adams School instructor, was one of them. Although I had met Winner before at various functions, and on one occasion we had spoken from the same platform, I did not know him well until he began attending our meetings. As a party type, he was the direct opposite of such ominous conspirators as Daniel Boone Shermer or Jack Satchel. He was a warm, jovial nature. He thoroughly enjoyed his human relationships in and out of the party and was perfectly at ease in any group. When the city of Malden celebrated its centennial anniversary a few years ago, Henry Winner, one of the most popular men in town, was selected chairman for the occasion. Curiously enough, one of those closest to Winner was the MIT professor, Dirk J. Struick, and they made an interesting study in contrast. Dirk was cold and calculating, perhaps the prototype of the pure scientist. He was not only a great mathematician, but an expert in Marxist theory as well. He combined these two fields in his flat assumption that Stalinism was founded in science. I have heard him lecture many times at the Samuel Adams School. He could hold a class of communists and non-communists alike absolutely spellbound, reeling off names, dates, facts, and figures in accurate detail without even glancing at his notes. The more I saw of Pro 4, the more varied and fascinating its membership became. Two young men whom I had known from my early days in the Young Communist League reappeared, this time as Boston attorneys and respected members of the bar. There was a successful author and a prominent Jewish leader, a labor union leader of great ability and with many valuable contacts among Boston newspapermen, joined Pro 4. Culture simply oozed out of our pro group. Graduate and honorary degrees were a dime a dozen. One of the most popular members of the group was a woman of great talent who could boast a family listed in Who's Who, European education, and a degree from a fashionable Eastern college. She had written a dozen successful books and was a leader in all sorts of women's clubs and professional groups. Her father had been a state Supreme Court justice in the state of New York. The question of money raising in our pro group was one of which at first amazed me. At one of the early meetings, I saw sums of 15 to 25 passed along casually to our treasurer. It was not long before I realized that the Pro 4 had ample resources on which to draw. The members were nicked for dues, sustaining fees, and innumerable drives, funds, and causes. In one such drive alone, our 80 members produced more than $3,500 in cash. One of our older and wealthier enthusiasts, Mrs. Sarah Gordon, the wife of an affluent jeweler, used to hold receptions in honor of such party stalwarts as Paul Robeson and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn in her Swank Hotel apartment with its magnificent sweeping view of the Charles River. At such affairs, money raising, in good taste of course, was an important item. These people were all well known, established residents of the Boston area, some of them suspected among the citizenry at large of having leftist tendencies, but none regarded openly as a member of the Communist Party. Many of them were among the most respected and most expert in their particular fields of endeavor. A few were wealthy. The cell to which I belonged numbered 10 to a dozen members before security measures required that it be broken down into smaller units. I learned that there were other cells also in the group, including a teacher's cell in the public schools, a small cell of government workers, two cells composed of writers, authors, newspapermen, and radio workers, a cell for lawyers, another for doctors, cells for college professors, including one at MIT and one at Harvard, a cell for phony ministers, a few of whom were ordained, and a cell for social workers. In all, it was estimated the pro-group membership in the Boston area numbered about 80 persons. In addition, there were a few pro-group floaters who were never permanently attached to any one cell. Although there were some 15 cells in existence in the fall of 1947, when I first joined the pro-group, each cell numbered from 3 to a dozen or 15 members, ours being one of the largest. The membership was reorganized from time to time as members moved away or new ones were brought in, or as their job status or party missions were changed. The pro-group operated with almost complete independence from the district leadership. Major party directives were passed to the group directly from the Communist Party National Headquarters in New York. Each cell had the prerogative of overruling district headquarters on such matters as membership. Quite often, a name submitted by the district leadership was turned down for lack of qualifications by the pro-group. Each cell designated a single representative to serve for it on the pro-council, which was the top governing body of the pro-group. The elections were held on a remarkably democratic footing, because these people were all thoroughly devoted communists, and there was little or no fear of defection among them. Cell members rarely commingled except on the pro-council level. This elaborate organization had a definite purpose, one of crucial importance to the Communist Party. The members of the pro-4 group represented the intelligentsia, the party intelligentsia, as distinguished from that of the bourgeoisie. They were the vanguard of the vanguard. Their mission as a group, through individual influence in their communities, businesses, professions, civic organizations, and local government, was to direct the thinking on all issues toward the tenets of Marxism-Leninism and toward conclusions that would aid the Communist Party. The particular value of the pro-group members, who diligently came together every 2 weeks for their own realignment, rested not alone on their influence and the high regard in which they were held in their communities, but also on the absence of any apparent ties with communism. Their hands appeared clean. They functioned through the elaborate party network of front organizations, and almost every pro-group member was energetic in his front activities. Some were active in scores of organizations of all kinds. The arrangement was somewhat the same as that in the Anthony Roche campaign for Congress, although on a much larger scale. But whereas in the case of Roche, a special underground committee had to be established to infiltrate the campaign, the pro-group stood as a permanent force, mobilized and highly mobile, prepared to move swiftly and efficiently wherever an issue arose or an organization afforded an opportunity for the spread of Stalinism. The pro-group was large enough to cover every important field of endeavor, and there were among its members experts in every segment of the cultural, commercial, and professional life of the community. Yet, it was small enough to escape detection. No task was too large or too small for the pro-group to tackle, and no outlet was overlooked. The activities within my own cell ranged from foisting of a communist peace crusade on a church meeting to the rewriting of a major speech for a presidential candidate. We directed strategy and a labor organizing drive. We served as a major money-raising arm for the party. We secured and passed on to higher echelons confidential information about important industrial firms. We did not frequently require orders from the cell or from pro-headquarters. We knew what to do without being told. Occasionally, however, direct orders were given in our biweekly meetings. Shortly after I became a member of Pro 4, such an order was given to me. It involved my own Wakefield Baptist Church and placed me in an embarrassing situation, but one from which I could not escape. The subject came up in connection with the intensive peace crusade, then being conducted by the International Communists. It was part of a campaign to allay fears of war, inspire disarmament, and lull the world to sleep in the face of communist aggression. Accordingly, I made arrangements for a speaker to address one of the church groups on the subject of peace. I could not, of course, warn my fellow Baptists that the speaker was a member of the professional group and a secret communist. They knew him only as a respected, well-educated Bostonian. The event was held, and the speech followed the party line to the letter. It was a complete apologia for Russia and the Soviet Union's obstructive tactics in the United Nations. The speaker urged us not to blame Russia for taking a position of defense against the imperialist nations which surrounded her. He declared that the Soviet Union had done its best to prevent World War II, and that only when these efforts were ignored by the free world did Stalin enter a non-aggression pact with Nazi Germany, forced upon him for his own protection. Needless to say, I sat through a very uncomfortable evening. That was an example of a small task, trivial in itself, but when multiplied by many similar jobs taken on by each cell member, and then again by 60 and more professional group members active in every phase of Boston community life, and still another time by 2,000 pro-group members throughout the country, it was a contribution of significance. As in every section and activity of the party, there is a fundamental Marxist precept on which the pro-group is based. In a booklet we studied, Culture in a Changing World, by V.J. Jerome, Karl Marx is quoted as saying, "Before the proletariat fights out its battles on the barricades, it announces the coming of its rule with a series of intellectual victories. The first problem is to win men's minds. When that is accomplished, the rest is easy." Many of the pro-group's offenses to win men's minds were more dramatic. Henry A. Wallace was brought to Boston for a major political rally at the Boston Garden during his 1948 presidential campaign. A part of his address was broadcast on the radio. A copy of his speech came into the office of the Progressive Party on Beacon Hill the day before the event and quickly found its way into the hands of my businessman friend from the pro cell. He regarded the speech as woefully inadequate, fuzzy, and confused. My friend called me at my office and asked me to hurry over. I sat down with him for more than 2 hours and worked over Wallace's phraseology. My friend rewrote the speech during the night, and by noon the following day it was mimeographed. Whether Wallace had time to read it before the broadcast, I never knew. But in any event, comrades in the pro group were delighted with the speech as it was given. During my 2 years in the pro group, we were assigned a multitude of similar tasks. I withheld myself from as much activity as I could, volunteering only enough to keep me in good standing. On one occasion, I was given one of our frequent coded orders to go to an apartment on Walnut Street. The reason for the mission was not described. On arrival, I found myself in the lavish apartment of Elizabeth Moose, at that time mother-in-law of William Remington, later tried for perjury for denying membership in the party. She was expecting me. We sat down and discussed arrangements for a Boston reception for the very Reverend Hewlett Johnson, the famous Red Dean of Canterbury, and a foremost apostle of the Communist Peace Crusade. The pro group worked intensively on the Progressive Party's campaign for Henry A. Wallace. "We have assigned some of our most important people to this task," I was told in a pro cell meeting. We were under strict orders in our Progressive Party work to maintain absolute secrecy as to Communist Party participation in the affairs of the organization. On Sunday, February 8, 1948, the State Convention of the Progressive Citizens of America was held in Boston to draw up a resolution, later to be transformed into the platform of the Progressive Party. There was a liberal sprinkling of pro-group members throughout the convention and its leadership. A good many floaters were on hand who had no connection with any cells. A glance at the platform is the best evidence of communist influence. It called for a complete rejection of the Marshall Plan for strengthening Western Europe, the withdrawal of all military personnel, equipment, and aid from Greece and Turkey, on whose borders communist pressure was constantly applied, the rejection of universal military training and drastic reduction of military expenditures to an absolute minimum, support of democratic Red China, repeal of President Truman's loyalty order and revocation of the power of the FBI. On the domestic scene, the communists wrote into the platform measure after measure which would make the people even more dependent on their government for everything in their lives, jobs, health, security, housing, education, et al. No one really expected a Wallace victory. But as in the Anthony Roche campaign, communist ideas were planted and class strife promoted. The entire program for the convention was discussed in detail at pro-cell meetings. Then it was handed over to a public committee of 3 persons for formal drafting. Finally, it was returned to a party floater, the the wife of an eminent scholar, and a woman against whom there is no legal evidence of the Communist Party membership, which she actually held. She made the final revisions and passed the program on to the Wallace Campaign Committee. The Bureau queried me, "Where do these orders come from? Who gives them?" In my cell, they usually came from Martha Fletcher, the cell leader. They came to Martha from Jan, who received them by courier from New York. The district headquarters were not only bypassed on numerous occasions, but in fact, orders were usually sent from the pro group to local functionaries. One cell member, a top public relations man, was assigned to the field of labor to assist communist unions in drawing up material which would best appeal to workers in organizational campaigns. Such a task included interviews with workers and union officials and careful studies of company counter-propaganda and business affairs. Sometimes several cell members took part in these studies, and the information was routed through my cell to other professional group members, who then went to work on preparation of the actual propaganda material. Another skilled career man said to be in the pro group worked in the heart of Boston's financial district, and he had ready access to facts and figures. He received periodic requests from the Communist Party for information as to the financial strength of Boston corporations, the composition of their directorates, their rates of earnings and profits, and similar material for use in compiling anti-capitalist propaganda. One of the pro-group members managed to get himself a post on the Governor's Study Commission for the drafting of a Fair Employment Practices Law. After the drafting was completed and the law was passed, it was arranged through a communist labor union to put pressure on the governor's office to have the same man named as a permanent commissioner to help administer the law. It was defeated when the details of the plot were laid before Governor Maurice J. Tobin by a particularly alert newspaper reporter, Cornelius Dalton of the Boston Traveler. While the members of the professional group were subjected to the usual discipline so far as loyalty was concerned, they were permitted greater freedom on the intellectual level than those in the lower ranks of the party. It was entirely possible to deviate in exploratory fashion, at least in a small way. On matters of broad general policy, no swerving from the party line was tolerated. For example, when Marshal Tito turned against the common form and was branded as a renegade by the International Party, pro-group members who had previously lauded him as a hero had to jump through the Stalin hoop with the same nimbleness as the others. But as Stalin declared, everything depends on the time, the place, and the conditions. Society is constantly changing, and the Communist Party must have enough flexibility to meet these changes. Not every order comes from Moscow, nor even from the national headquarters. The pro-group section of the party throughout the country, led by the best minds the party could muster, held it within their power to call the tune on local matters. So this is a really interesting chapter. I'll pull out some of the pull quotes here. One thing at the very beginning, one thing I did know, there is only one way to find and expose the underground communist. You have to get right in there with him, down in the muck and mud. There's no other way. And he did, and he was in there for quite a few years. And the more he gets in, the more he realizes what a challenge it is to find these people. Another quote, "These people were all well-known established residents of the Boston area. Some of them suspected among the citizenry at large of having leftist tendencies, but none regarded openly as a member of the Communist Party. Many of them were among the most respected and most expert in their particular fields of endeavor. A few were wealthy." This idea that a communist is one of these bohemian types, you know, hey man, it's all good kind of guys and gals, and he talks about that some in there. And he says, "The cell to which I belong numbered 10 to a dozen members before security measures required that it be broken down into smaller units." Okay, so first off, they've got their security dialed in. And don't think for a second that they don't have that dialed in now. It's probably even easier. So you've got all these open communists, just like then, out there smashing windows, throwing bricks at cops, doing that kind of stuff. And then you've got the secret communists, the professors, and the just, oh, he's just a leftist. Well, is he? He says, "I learned that there were other cells also in the group, including a teacher's cell in the public schools. A small cell of government workers. Two cells composed of writers, authors, newspapermen, and radio workers. Two of businessmen. They sell for lawyers, another for doctors, sells for college professors, including one at MIT. They had a whole cell at MIT. Oh, and one at Harvard. Are you surprised? You shouldn't be surprised, but I'm not surprised. However, what this is proof. Proof that what we've all been saying is true, and what conservatives and what Ronald Reagan and what many others have been saying over the years is true about these communists. Their mission as a group, through individual influence in their communities, businesses, professions, civic organizations, and local governments, was to direct the thinking on all issues toward the tenets of Marxism-Leninism and toward conclusions that would aid the Communist Party. I know that sounds familiar. I know it sounds familiar in our schools, it sounds familiar in our government, in our colleges, in our businesses, in the unions, for those of you that have to work in a union shop. In fact, our company just said in their employee manual that we will not be a union operation, which I loved. I would quit. There is no way. Been a part of enough useless unions over the years, I would quit. The pro group was large enough to cover every important field of endeavor, and there were among its members experts in every segment of the cultural, commercial, and professional life of the community. Yet it was small enough to escape detection. There are some things and lessons we could learn there, patriots. So as the militia movement is shrinking, you've made some good friends in there. You've met some people you think you can trust. Get together in smaller groups and train and get your security figured out. Get your encryption online. Learn about ham radio and communication. There are some lessons we could learn from these scumbags. Now, he talks about this time where he had to actually help the communists do propaganda stuff in his church. And he was not too happy about it, but there's nothing he could do. You know, if he wants to move forward, he has to do this. You don't say no. You don't say no when the party says go. This was interesting. This is a quote from Karl Marx, and this is before the proletariat fights out its battles on the barricades. It announces the coming of its rule with a series of intellectual victories. The first problem is to win men's minds. When that is accomplished, the rest is easy. Your children are being propagandized, whether they're in the government high schools, whether they're up in colleges, up at VCU, as they walk through the bookstore and there's a pride table of books, all the gay authors. You have a table for those interested in witchcraft and divination. You have an entire section on current events, but it's all propaganda. It's all saying Trump is evil, Biden is great, Fox News sucks, and all this type of stuff. And then you have another table over there, you know, right in the middle of the aisle where everybody walks, that says, you're a racist if you don't agree with X, Y, and Z. They're winning men's minds. And then the rest is easy. Before you go and fight at the barricades, the rest is easy if you win men's minds. The progressive movement's party platform, he talks about that and how it was pretty much lockstep with. And he talks about that. I'll go ahead and read it. It says, it called for the complete rejection of the Marshall Plan for strengthening Western Europe, the withdrawal of all military personnel, equipment, and aid from Greece and Turkey, on whose borders communist pressure was constantly applied. The rejection, Greece and Turkey, right now, is where all of the Muslim invasion is taking place. So that's an interesting twist on in history. The rejection of universal military training and drastic reduction of military expenditures to an absolute minimum. Support of democratic red China, repeal of President Trump's loyalty order, and revocation of the power of the FBI. On the domestic scene, the communists wrote into the platform measure after measure, which would make people even more dependent on the government for everything in their lives. Jobs, health, security, housing, education. Sound familiar? Sounds familiar to me. This is, you turn on the news right now. You're going to hear all this stuff. And they use Pro 4 to do it. They use this organization's supposedly non-communist nature. And they use these people within this organization inside political organizations, inside companies. You don't think that this is happening now? Look at Coca-Cola inside their own company telling people they need to be less white. Company after company after company is infested with these people. And it's gotten to the point where they don't even have to hide anymore. They can be out there in the open. Amazing insights into the life of a communist. We have four more chapters to the completion of the book. If you hadn't had a chance to hear the rest of those and hear the whole story here, I would encourage you to go back and listen to those. I've started to, at the beginning of this year, put when things happen in a show. So if you just want to skip all the other stuff, you can do that. I would encourage you to listen to it. I think you'd be entertained and learn a few things. However, if you just want to get the I Led Three Lives section of the show, then you can find that.
And come to troubles in your own kit bag and smile, smile, smile. While you the Lucifer to light your fang, smile, boys, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. So, back up to troubles in your own kit bag and smile, smile, smile.
This is from Survival Blog, and this is something that might put a smile on a patriot's face. Might give you a little cause for concern, but hopefully should encourage you to not be a FUD. So, and this is all the way back actually from 2018. James Wesley Rawls is the author, and it's called The Mathematics of Countering Tyranny. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to bounce around a little bit, but I will put the link in the show notes and you can take a look. So this is the collectivist dream. The collectivist gun grabbers have the dream of ignoring the Second Amendment and somehow magically removing all detachable magazines, semi-auto rifles from civilian hands. But it is just that, a dream. If they think they can disarm us, then they are thoroughly deluded. I'll explain why with some simple mathematics. There are somewhere between 370 million and 420 million privately owned firearms in the United States. Let's just call it 400 million for a nice round figure. Most of those guns are not registered to particular owners. That is why there are only rough estimates. Makes me feel good to know that Big Brother has no idea where those guns are and who owns them. When I last checked, the total U.S. population is 327,708,000. So that's just about 1.2 guns per person. The adult population is around 249 million. And according to Wikipedia, the fit-for-service military age male population between 16 and 49 of the U.S. is just 59,764,677. That equates to 6.6 guns per military-age male in the United States. Goes on to cite some more statistics here. Jumping ahead, we have aggregate gun math. If a production and importation ban requiring registration were enacted, there would surely be massive noncompliance. I've talked about this before. For example, the registration schemes enacted in the past two decades in Australia, Canada, the Philippines, Indonesia, Brazil, and the state of California and New York, as well as, I believe, Connecticut. You didn't mention that here. Have all been documented failures. They have been met with noncompliance rates ranging from 50% to 90%. That's pretty high. Even with an optimistic 50% registration compliance rate, that would mean only 10 million of the nation's 20 million semi-auto rifles would have a current name and address attached to even allow eventual gun confiscation. Then he jumps down and he's talking about the SWAT and ATF manpower math. So let's suppose that the full federal semi-auto ban were enacted, that a gun confiscation order was issued. This is where the math gets interesting. There are only 902,000 sworn police officers in the United States. at most, about 80,000 of them have had SWAT training. There are only 5,000 BATFE employees, and many of them are paper shufflers. As of 2017, there were just 2,600 ATF special agents. The FBI notorious HRT has a cadre strength that is classified, but presumably less than 200 agents. Together, they comprise the pool of door kickers that might be available to execute unconstitutional search warrants. If they were to start going door to door executing warrants for unconstitutional gun confiscation, what would the casualty rates be for ATF HRT and the assorted local SWAT teams? It bears mentioning that the military would most likely be out of the picture since they are banned from domestic law enforcement roles under the Posse Comitatus Act. So that's assuming they don't repeal that. But I've said before, you're not going to have a problem with the local National Guard because most of them are people like you and me. You're not going to have a problem with most local cops because they're not going to risk their lives. And you'll get into some of the stats here in a sec on that for this this kind of an action. So let's keep going. Next, let's do some additional math and then divide. 80,000 SWAT-trained police plus ATF special agents, FBI HRT members. That's 82,863 potential available door kickers, presumably working in teams of eight, attempting to seize 9 million newly contraband semi-auto rifles. Before we finish the math, I'll state some for the sake of argument assumptions. That every SWAT-trained officer in the country is pressed into service. That there would be no false positives, meaning that 100% of the tips leading to raids were accurate, unlikely. That no local police departments would opt out of serving unconstitutional federal gun warrants, unlikely. That all raids would be successful, unlikely. That each successful raid would net an average of 3 contraband semi-auto rifles, possible. That every door kicker would get an equal share of the work, very unlikely. And that every door kicker would be alive and well through the entire campaign of terror with no incapacitating injuries or deaths of SWAT officers, no refusals, no resignations, and no early retirements. Very unlikely. A lot of those are not safe assumptions, but for the sake of completing this experiment, let's pen this out on the back of a napkin as a best case for the unconstitutional gun confiscation campaign. And here are the division equations. 9 million divided by 9 million is the number he said after it was all said and done of what they think that they could. Okay, we know there's 9 million guns we can go find. Divided by 82,863 is 108 times 8 officers per team. That's 864 raids per officer. Let that sink in. Every officer would have to survive 864 gun-grabbing raids. And how long would it be before or until mounting law enforcement casualties triggered a revolt or sick out among the ranks, rank-and-file door kickers. For some historical context, just 4 ATF agents were killed and 16 wounded in the Waco raid, and that was considered quite devastating and traumatizing to the 5,000-member agency. Here is some sobering ground truth. America's gun owners are just as well-trained and often better trained than the police. There are 20.4 million American military veterans, and the majority of veterans own guns. I'm going to read that line, part of that again. American gun owners are just as well trained and often better trained than the police. I 100% agree with that. If you know any police officers and you talk to them, they get trained maybe once a year, if they're lucky. And right now, I don't even know if that's happening. They use COVID as an excuse, but they don't have any ammo. So how are you going to train? Okay, resistance and strategy tactics. He has a long list here. I'm not going to share all of them. Rather than meeting the police one at a time on their doorsteps, I predict that resisting gun owners will employ guerrilla warfare strategy and tactics to foil the plans of the gun grabbers. They will form small, fully independent phantom resistance cells, commonly called leaderless resistance. Such cells are very difficult to detect and penetrate. These resistance cells will carefully choose the time and location of their attacks to their advantage. They will individually target the legislators who voted for unconstitutional gun ban legislation. This will make it almost suicidal for these legislators to return to their home districts. They will pillage or burn down the facilities where confiscated guns are being stored and destroyed. They will begin a war of attrition on the door kickers with tactics such as these, ambushing SWAT vehicles while in transit rather than waiting for SWAT teams to set up raids, targeting SWAT teams or individual team members while they are home, in training, or when attending conventions. They will individually target gun control advocates, organizers, and group leaders. They will individually target the judges that issue gun seizure warrants. Some owners of M1 carbines, AR-15s, and HKs in the resistance movement will convert them to select fire. All right, question. I'm not that familiar with the M1, but I didn't know full auto was an option. Anyone got any thoughts on that? But they will assume, well, if it's now a felony to possess a semi-auto, then what's the harm in making it full auto? And jumping down here, goes talks about a couple different things, but then he says there's more. The foregoing math on the roughly 20 million semi-auto rifles is not the full extent of the problem for the gun grabbers. There are also perhaps 40 million scoped centerfire deer rifles in private hands. The vast majority of those have no traceable paper trail, fully capable of 500 yards or more engagements. These rifles could be employed to outrange the tyrants and their minions. He says, finally, now to get back to the simple mathematics, here are some ratios to ponder. NRA members, 5.2 million. To door kickers, 82,863. So 63-1 ratio. Military vets, 20 million to 82,249-1. Unregistered machine guns, he talks a little bit about that. 1.5 million to door kickers, 82,000 to 18-1. Privately owned semi-auto rifles, 40 million to door kickers, 82,000, so 485-1. And some of these numbers, you got to read the whole thing to understand what he's talking about here. Unintended consequences. I'll conclude with a word of caution. Leftist American politicians should be careful about what they wish for. Those who hate the Second Amendment and scheme to disarm us have no clue about the unintended consequences of their plans. If they proceed, then I can foresee that it will end very badly for them. James Wesley Rawls. And I would actually throw out a word of caution there for those of you in the law enforcement community. You really should quit if they do stuff like this, because he's right. People aren't going to put up with this. We've seen where this goes in every country that's done it, and we're not going to have it here. So I hope that math encourages you a little, and hopefully it makes the agents of tyranny and the tyrants themselves think twice. We'll see. So why even share a post like that? I mean, so what, right? I'll tell you why. Because there's all this talk right now. They're going after our guns. My guns. They're going after my guns. They're going to take my guns. Ain't never going to take my guns. And then you hear all kinds of other silly stuff like, oh, I lost all those in a boating accident. Stupid junk like that. No. They're not going to take your guns. Oh, they can try. And maybe the end goal is maybe they want everything to devolve into what was illustrated here in this post. Maybe that's their goal. Maybe that's what they want. Hard to say. You know, there's all this talk this week by Bumbles and others about, shootings that have happened. You know, how many mass shootings did we have when Donald Trump was president? I don't know. Wasn't many. You notice that there seems to be a lot more when the Democrats are controlling things. And they use that as a stick and a carrot. Oh, just give us universal background checks. Come on. We need this. It's for the good of our society, right? That's what communists do. Well, that'll do it for this show this week. I'd like to thank you for listening. And I'd like to remind you that you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon, and this is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.